Thanks for listening to The Kick-Ass Life with David Wood. Stay connected on Facebook, / The Kick-Ass Life, on Twitter, at The Kick-Ass Life, and of course, at thekickasslife.com.
Jambo, fellow adventurers, this is Mike Dooley, and you are listening to David Wood on The Kick-Ass Life Show.
Kick-ass. Want to make your life better? This is the Kick-Ass Life Podcast with David Wood.
Hey there, it's Thursday, so I'm riding solo, and I'm getting pretty excited because it won't be too many days from now that I will be heading down under, mate. Down under. Over to Australia for my month in Australia every year, the month of October. I set sail for the land down under. And I know that's a good setup for a song, but no, I'm going to hold back. I just thought I want to thank a few of the Aussies before I get there who have gone to iTunes and left a review. So just a few names. I want to throw them out there as a thank you. One's Fantastic Find by Ben Joe Craig. Thank you, Ben Joe Craig. And this is thanks and sincere gratitude from Mama Tool. Hi, Mama Tool. And don't delay. Subscribe today. And that's by Alabelle. Hi, Alabelle. See you down there. And little mini dot Magoo says, David with John Gray. He's talking about one of the shows, the old shows, Goosebumps About the Kick-Ass Life by Emily B. Emily B. And Inspiring by Jenny L75. The last one, Listen and You'll See by Moi Aussie de Plus. Moi Aussie de Plus. Thank you. And I must admit, I really, really, really love. If you haven't been down there yet, if you haven't been to Australia, you know, you got to go. You got to go. And of course, there's some great bands there too. You know, what about Men at Work, hey? What about it?
I'm bred from a man in Brussels. He was 6'4" and full of muscle. I said, do you speak my language? He just smiled and gave me a Vegemite sandwich. And he said, I come from a land down under.
Come on, you got to be honest. If you're sitting there in your office right now, you're jogging down the boardwalk or walking your dog in the woods, you know who you are. Maybe you're washing some plates. You want to come. You want to come to Australia with me, don't you? Be honest. Of course you do. Who doesn't? I mean, who doesn't love Australia? You know, there's those weird people that say, oh, there's too many spiders. You know, I've been there dozens and dozens and dozens. I haven't even ever seen a spider. I've seen more spiders in my backyard here in Canada. Anyway, so looking forward, and thanks to you all you Aussies. And they call me the whinging pommy bastard. You know it's true down there, although I'm not a whingy, although there's a lot of them, right? But, you know, I'm just really wondering what I'm going to chat about today. And I have a feeling about something. There's this the thing I used to say a lot where you know, this idea of being right. And you know, it's one of those things where, you know, I used to say on stage, you can be right or you can be rich, you can be right or you can be happy. And the truth is, I learned something a long, long, long time ago when I was in Egypt of all countries, my second country. I was a little wet behind the ears and terrified, but I remember living in Cairo. And Cairo is an amazing city, but I mean, the noise, I mean, just the horns and the, you know, the sound of traffic. And I was just off Talahub Square and there was a little pension there called Pension Oxford. It cost me 25 cents a night. And I met an Aussie girl there, Peter. Funny as heck that was. She, we're all backpackers and, you know, we had to pay for a bath. So we decided to share a bath together. Well, and I thought that was amazing because, I mean, here I am. I'm this sort of, you know, this Brit, you know, stiff upper lip and all that. What? Oh, yes, lovely, yes. I thought sex was something you put potatoes in. Anyway, so there's this Aussie, mate, you like to share a bath? I'm thinking, sure, why not? So Pension Oxford, sharing a bath with this person I never met. And we sat there laughing and joking. And then because we washed all of our clothes in the bathwater, because there wasn't a lot of water. But, you know, traveling through Egypt and, you know, I remember the Cairo Museum. I was sitting and looking at Tutankhamun's mask for hours and just mesmerized that someone made this thing out of solid gold. Just unbelievably beautiful. And, you know, the whole of Cairo, I mean, climbing the Great Giza Pyramid. And late in the evening, just as the light show is going off and we're being chased by guards, you know, we shouldn't be really up there, but we decided to climb it. You know, on the Step Pyramid of Saqqara, and, you know, just so many amazing things. And then we took a third class train down to the Valley of the Kings, and we wanted to see the Valley of the Kings. So we rented bikes and we rode and we took the ferry across the river there over the Nile. And we decided it was just a little bit too touristy. So we decided that we would ditch our bikes. And we'd hike in through the sort of the rugged mountains behind the Valley of Kings. Me and my buddy Paul Orchid, who's also from Melbourne. I don't think he listens to the show, but Paul, if you're listening, hello, mate. Yes, you're going all right. Anyway, so we climb up and we see this kind of bricked up cave with a kind of a, you know, big square brick missing in the right hand corner top. And we decide to climb in there. So like a couple of idiots and we climbed out of this cave and it's pitch black. We have no flashlight. There was no cell phones back then where we were sort of like lighting up the way. And at the bottom, I decided to take a photograph with my flash. And then we took like four photographs of all around cause we couldn't see, but we were a little bit scared. I'll be honest with you. And, you know, back in those days, we didn't have any digital camera. Back in those days when I was a lad, oh, we didn't have any digital cameras, you know. So I had to wait, right? And so, you know, 3 months later, I get these photos. And we're in a sarcophagus and there's like hieroglyphics and there's like stars painting on the ceiling and this little place that we'd crawled into. It was unbelievable. I think I have the photograph still somewhere, right? So, you know, Egypt was a great place, but they had some philosophies, the pharaohs. And I met two people there that really were interesting. Bruce, who was this American, and Paul is Aussie. And Paul was this, you know, crazy, crazy, always getting into trouble kind of guy. And Bruce was kind of this academic. So Bruce used to lead me around and teach me everything. And so, because I wasn't a big studier, so he'd take me and he was my official tour guide of Cairo. And, you know, and he was talking about how the pharaohs had many answers to a problem. So they didn't have to be one answer. So, you know, how was the sky held up? They didn't have to be one answer. There could be 10 answers and they were all okay. So they would accept all the answers from all the different things. There wasn't a struggle with you're wrong, I'm right. You know, yeah, that's terrible. What I'm saying is correct. You know, whatever. There's none of that. You could have it all. It could be both. It could be held up by columns. It could be held up by the legs of a woman. It could be held up by the legs of a cow. All those were ideas of it, right? And one of the funny stories there actually was, I remember this, if you had a student visa, and I left school at 15, I didn't have a student visa, you could get half price of all of the, you know, like museums and all that kind of stuff. So we went down and I didn't have a photograph of me. I only had a photograph of Bruce. So I get a student visa, which I have to bribe someone for. And there's a photograph with my name on with Bruce's photograph on. And we go there. And now there's me and him together with same photograph. I put my finger over the photograph. It didn't matter. They still have a look at it and, you know, and blah, 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 right? But that's why I like sometimes a little corruption's okay if you can bribe your way in somewhere. I didn't say that. Did I say that out loud? You know, it's time for a song, isn't it? It's got to be.
Walk like an Egyptian. The blonde waitresses take their trays, spin around, and they cross the floor. They've got the moves. Oh, you drop your drink.
Anyway, it's worth it. Get there. Many, many fond memories of Egypt. My pension, I used to joke. The bed bugs had fleas. But, you know, you don't have to travel on 25 cents a day like I did. Oh, you know, here's a funny story, too. I just had all these stories popping up in my head. Honestly, I didn't think about what I was going to say before I pushed record. So this is just coming out. This is coming out live and raw. But I remember, you know, the bathrooms there, right? They're squat toilets. And I was still a little bit uptight, you know, still a uptight Brit. And so I used to walk down to the Hilton Hotel and I would wait. I would pace myself. And you walk in there and have this luxury five-star toilet. There'd be a little man in there handing me a little... I couldn't afford to tip him, though. So that was my indulgence in Egypt, was the Hilton Hotel bathrooms was my indulgence. Anyway, so let's get back to what this subject's all about, right? This idea that, you know, we so often we get... We get trapped in our own thinking. We get trapped in what we feel is the truth. And so, you know, where does the truth come from? Quite often our environment, you know, we grew up in an environment. If you grew up in one part of the world, and I had two girlfriends that I dated, one was Indian and one was from Guatemala, both raised by American parents. So they were adopted out as babies, you know, and so when you're intimate with someone who's from who looks like one culture and sounds like another and grew up with American ideals and American schools. And with the furthest thing from anything of their own culture where they, you know, they were born, because the environment plays such a massive role on who they are. And so that's the same for all of us. I mean, you guys listening in right now, you know, your environment has played a role on what you believe to be true. You know, people ask me, you know, do I believe in, you know, like UFOs and do I believe in ghosts? You know, I mean, but, you know, and the truth is, you know, I've got to be honest. I grew up in England and, you know, there was definitely, you know, in the area where I grew up, there was so much about, ghosts, and you know, there was the most haunted church probably in the world is a Bawley Rectory. I've talked about it before. Me and Jimmy used to go there sort of ghost hunting. You know, I never saw one, you know, and it would be there. I went to seances, you know, I went to all these different things because that was very, very much a part of our culture, you know, certainly where I was growing up. And so, you know, did I see one? No. And people ask me about UFOs. I mean, am I open to it? Absolutely. Why wouldn't I be? Why would I not be open to it? And would I like to be picked up and have an experience with some space guy? Sure. Why not? Do I believe it's true? I have no idea. Do I have to have an opinion? Do I have to say, yes, it's true or no, it's false? I have no idea. I choose to keep the door open. So the door's open on the whole ghost debate. The door's open because, I mean, yeah, I could say no based on what? Based on a feeling, an inkling, because I read a book, because I spoke to Bob down the pub and he had a really good sort of idea about it. Or what? What am I going to choose in the end? Or am I going to stay open to the possibility of all things? Oh, it doesn't matter where it's at. So, you know, even if you have strong faith and say, okay, this is the way I believe, but could you keep the door open for everyone else so that when you're with them, there's the ability to mingle and mix and talk and get into rich conversations without one being right and one being wrong. It's the right, wrong thing. You know, you can be right, you can be rich, you can be right, you can be happy, but everyone else has to be wrong for you to be right. And it's such a small world to live in because suddenly your opinion is exactly, yeah, that's wrong. Really? How do you know? How do you know? And have you really investigated it? It's like, yeah, you know, where did the opinions come from? Is it a first-hand account or is it something that you picked up from speaking to someone who spoke to someone or you read a book somewhere, whatever, right? And I think that that's something that really traps us in a small world. Is this small world thinking? And I'd like to share something with you, which I think is really, it's a fascinating, fascinating talk. And what I like about this is that there's Andrew Solomon is his name. And he talks about love no matter what. And I want you to listen into this. And as you do, I want you to really allow your mind to wander back into your own history about how often you've had strong opinions about something that at the time seemed, okay, this is what I believe. But later on, based on new experiences, based on meeting someone from that ethnicity or whatever it is, you know, suddenly a whole new door, a whole new world opens up because of an experience. But actually, there was a time when the door was closed, or there was an opinion that was so strong, well, you know, that person's like this because, without any real understanding. So a kick-ass life, I think, is something where there is this opening that consistently exists in every moment, in every situation, even when you think you're right, that you can have that opinion. Well, I think I'm right there. However, the door's still open. Of course, I'm still willing to be open to the possibility of something grander being there that I can experience. So let's just listen in and really sort of figure this out together. And as we do, what I would love to do is I'd love you to, again, make sure you put yourself into these words. Go back into your own history to a time where maybe you were trapped in a thought process that proved itself to simply not be true, to proved itself to actually be completely untrue. Or maybe you witnessed, and I'll talk about my brother in a bit, right? My brother, I'll talk about it after this. Just listen in to Andrew Solomon.
Even in purely non-religious terms, homosexuality represents a misuse of the sexual faculty. It is a pathetic little second-rate substitute for reality, a pitiable flight from life. As such, it deserves no compassion, it deserves no treatment as minority martyrdom, and it deserves not to be deemed anything but a pernicious sickness. That's from Time magazine in 1966 when I was 3 years old. And last year, the President of the United States came out in favor of gay marriage. And my question is, how did we get from there to here? How did an illness become an identity? When I was perhaps 6 years old, I went to a shoe store with my mother and my brother, and at the end of buying our shoes, the salesman said to us that we could each have a balloon to take home. My brother wanted a red balloon, and I wanted a pink balloon. My mother said that she thought I'd really rather have a blue balloon, but I said that I definitely wanted the pink one, and she reminded me that my favorite color was blue. The fact that my favorite color now is blue, but I'm still gay, is evidence of both my mother's influence and its limits. When I was little, my mother used to say, "The love you have for your children is like no other feeling in the world. And until you have children, you don't know what it's like." And when I was little, I took it as the greatest compliment in the world that she would say that about parenting my brother and me. And when I was an adolescent, I thought, "But I'm gay, and so I probably can't have a family." And when she said it, it made me anxious. And after I came out of the closet, when she continued to say it, it made me furious. I said, "I'm gay. That's not the direction that I'm headed in, and I want you to stop saying that." About 20 years ago, I was asked by my editors at the New York Times Magazine to write a piece about deaf culture, and I was rather taken aback. I had thought of deafness entirely as an illness. Those poor people, they couldn't hear, they lacked hearing, and what could we do for them? And then I went out into the deaf world. I went to deaf clubs. I saw performances of deaf theater and of deaf poetry. I even went to the Miss Deaf America contest in Nashville, Tennessee, where people complained about that slurry Southern signing. And as I plunged deeper and deeper into the deaf world, I became convinced that deafness was a culture, and that the people in the deaf world who said, "We don't lack hearing, we have membership in a culture," were saying something that was viable. It wasn't my culture, and I didn't particularly want to rush off and join it, but I appreciated that it was a culture, and that for the people who were members of it, it felt as valuable as Latino culture or gay culture or Jewish culture. It felt as valid, perhaps even as American culture. Then a friend of a friend of mine had a daughter who was a dwarf. And when her daughter was born, she suddenly found herself confronting questions that now began to seem quite resonant to me. She was facing the question of what to do with this child. Should she say, you're just like everyone else, but a little bit shorter? Or should she try to construct some kind of dwarf identity, get involved in the little people of America, become aware of what was happening for dwarfs? And I suddenly thought, most deaf children are born to hearing parents. Those hearing parents tend to try to cure them. Those deaf people discover community somehow in adolescence. Most gay people are born to straight parents. Those straight parents often want them to function in what they think of as the mainstream world, and those gay people have to discover identity later on. And here was this friend of mine looking at these questions of identity with her dwarf daughter, and I thought, there it is again, a family that perceives itself to be normal with a child who seems to be extraordinary. And I hatched the idea that there are really two kinds of identity. There are vertical identities, which are passed down generationally from parent to child. Those are things like ethnicity, frequently nationality, language, often religion. Those are things you have in common with your parents and with your children. And while some of them can be difficult, there's no attempt to cure them. You could argue that it's harder in the United States, our current presidency notwithstanding, to be a person of color. And yet, we have nobody who is trying to ensure that the next generation of children born to African Americans and Asians come out with creamy skin and yellow hair. There are these other identities which you have to learn from a peer group. And I call them horizontal identities because the peer group is the horizontal experience. These are identities that are alien to your parents and that you have to discover when you get to see them in peers. And those identities, those horizontal identities, people have almost always tried to cure. And I wanted to look at what the process is through which people who have those identities come to a good relationship with them. And it seemed to me that there were three levels of acceptance that needed to take place. There's self-acceptance, there's family acceptance, and there's social acceptance. And they don't always coincide. And a lot of the time, people who have these conditions are very angry because they feel as though their parents don't love them, when what actually has happened is that their parents don't accept them. Love is something that ideally is there unconditionally throughout the relationship between a parent and a child. But acceptance is something that takes time. It always takes time. One of the dwarfs I got to know was a guy named Clinton Brown. When he was born, he was diagnosed with diastrophic dwarfism, a very disabling condition, and his parents were told that he would never walk, he would never talk, he would have no intellectual capacity, and he would probably not even recognize them. And it was suggested to them that they leave him at the hospital so that he could die there quietly. And his mother said she wasn't going to do it, and she took her son home, and even though she didn't have a lot of educational or financial advantages, she found the best doctor in the country for dealing with diastrophic dwarfism, and she got Clinton enrolled with him, and in the course of his childhood, he had 30 major surgical procedures. And he spent all this time stuck in the hospital while he was having those procedures, as a result of which he now can walk. And while he was there, they sent tutors around to help him with his schoolwork, and he worked very hard because there was nothing else to do, and he ended up achieving at a level that had never before been contemplated by any member of his family. He was the first one in his family, in fact, to go to college, where he lived on campus and drove a specially fitted car that accommodated his unusual body. And his mother told me the story of coming home one day, and he went to college nearby, and she said, and I saw that car, which you can always recognize, in the parking lot of a bar, she said. And I thought to myself, they're 6 feet tall, he's 3 feet tall, 2 beers for them is 4 beers for him. She said, I knew I couldn't go in there and interrupt him, but I went home and I left him 8 messages on his cell phone. She said, and then I thought, if someone had said to me when he was born that my future worry would be that he'd go drinking and driving with his college buddies. And I said to her, what do you think you did that helped him to emerge as this charming, accomplished, wonderful person? And she said, What did I do? I loved him, that's all. Clinton just always had that light in him, and his father and I were lucky enough to be the first to see it there.
Isn't that beautiful? And by the way, if you want to go and listen to the whole thing, I'll put it in the show notes. So just go to the website, kickasslife.com, and you can find the show notes, or you could just put in the kickasslife.com and just put in the episode number. And you will find that. So, you know, again, when you look at where we're going with this conversation, and we look at the fact that, that so much of what we thought to be true is completely untrue. And so many areas where we thought we were right, we've been proved to be wrong by science or by time. And so what would happen? What would happen if we were just open all the time to all things? Maybe we could eradicate opinion, where this is my opinion. I know it sounds kind of, my dad used to say that, if you have no opinion unless you vote, right? I understand that. What I don't get is where a barrier between two people is created because one feels they're right. I don't get is where because somebody is from a certain country or because somebody has a certain orientation, that somebody else in their wisdom feels that they have an opinion that's strong enough to separate them from them and to isolate themselves. And I believe that's what truly happens, is in the end, that strong opinion is what creates the isolation for ourselves. And we see it with faith. You know, I have so many friends of all faiths. And the ones who have the strongest faith sometimes are live in the smallest boxes because everyone else is wrong around them. And again, I don't want to start that whole thing. Don't be switching off now. I'm not going to listen to him anymore because he says something about faith. I want you to think about, and you said, in other words, the and I can have this. I can have my faith and my beliefs and be strong in them. And I can be open to the possibility of conversation even. It doesn't mean that the other people are right, but it doesn't mean that everyone else is wrong because I'm right. And I think that's something that, again, you know, when I look at this whole conversation about, you know, right and wrong, when I look at the Pharaoh's words and I look at how many people, my brother I was going to talk about, right? My brother, we found out that he was gay. My mom found out when he was gay. And remember, I mean, so I'm 52. So my brother would have been about 16 or 15, 16 at the time. So figure out the math. And she was ballistic, absolutely ballistic, and screaming and yelling and you know, trying to sort of, you know, trying to wash it off his skin, this disease that he had, right? And so my brother ended up marrying somebody and having two children. But you know, this desire in him and this way of the way he is, and he's passed away now. But you know, his destiny, I don't know how you term it. I don't want to use a term that, but you know, the guy that he was, that emerged when he was young, and that was hidden away for all those years, reemerged at the end of his marriage, and he ended up marrying a guy. But you know, it was really interesting to see the societal push on him to say, look, this isn't who you are. This is who you are. And he was never happy in his marriage. And consequently, his kids were never happy because he was never happy. And again, you know, this is just an example of this. I look at my life story and I'm so grateful, to have these experiences firsthand and to see them and to see how they play out today. When you look at the world today and we look at the understanding of, if we look at that one situation, and I want to play a song now though, from a great band. You'll probably understand the significance of the song. Here we go.
To break free.
I really hope you get this, the essence of this. And, you know, it's sometimes, you know, when I'm doing all this and, you know, I'm, doing the, I'm the guy, right? Doing the music and searching it while I'm talking and all the rest of it, right? Yeah, and it's because it's more intuitive. It's more happening in the moment. I don't have notes written down or anything like that. So sometimes, you know, my mind does wander a little bit, and I hope you get the point of what this is all about, you know, and the possibility that lies within this type of conversation, where we can truly, truly sort of look at the world differently, and really look at it with tolerance and with opening, with understanding, with curiosity, with fascination. And I really love the idea of fascination, you know, and, you know, the idea that, you know, when we're fascinated by everything, when we're fascinated by people, when we're fascinated by situations, by new experiences, fascinated by food, that, you know, the world opens up in such a magnificent way. And it's just there. It's succulent. It's beautiful. It's everything. And the moment we put our own stake in the ground of what we think is right and wrong and what we think, and not saying we can't have those beliefs, but what about the and? The belief and I'm open to discovering more. The belief and I'm open to really having all people in my life. I'm open and I have a forgiving heart. You know, it's like people who make mistakes, you know, people on death row. You know, I mean, truly, I believe that in every single dark place, there's a seed of greatness and a seed of gold. There's something beautiful. And if we have the power to see that light, it will emerge. And much like my guest there, Andrew, you know, was talking about with the mom, you know, we were the lucky to be the first to see that in him. So he lived into the lightness they saw in him. And so, you know, I just think that it's one of those beautiful situations that we have right now, is to make the choice now, today. How do we choose into this opening of possibility with all situations? And with that being said, I want to leave you with a couple of things. Just the show, the only way you can help out right now, there's going to be lots of ways in the future. We've got a lot of great stuff coming to link arms with us and to help us reach more people and to get this in more hands, is to share it with some friends and share a show that you like. If there's something meaningful in a show, share the actual show with someone and sort of encourage your friends and coworkers and loved ones to have a listen in. But just give them something specific to listen to. There's, you know, 230 shows now. Also, if you want to leave a review, that's the way we can get established more. We get a bigger foothold in the door and more people will find us if there's a review. So, you know, giving a rating, a star rating and writing a review means that you have to log on to iTunes and have your password, but it's not too difficult, right? But the kickasslife.com, you can go to subscribe if you want to leave a review, the kickasslife.com. And then, you know, if you want to join me on Facebook, David on Facebook.com. Love to join in there and share your thoughts and love you to be a part of that. And then, of course, Thatch Key. I talked about on Tuesday's show about the possibility of doing a Kick-Ass Life Adventure club, a first kind of like week. I'm going to be down in Belize anyway, training on a program. So I'm going to be on the island. I thought, well, why don't we just do something while I'm there? I'm already going to be there. I can make it magical. I love this place. It's my own private island. You know, it's a mile long. It's in a UNESCO World Heritage Site. It's part of a marine sanctuary. I could make the most amazing week of your life. It's not going to be very much money because I'm already down there. So there's not, I don't have to recoup massive expenses. So it's going to be very, very affordable. There's room for 28 people. And so first 28 people that go online, to my Facebook, so davidonfacebook.com, and say, I want to come. It's going to be a couple of grand, just over maybe $2,300, somewhere around there max. And then that's all your food and accommodations included. You just have to fly to Belize City. We've had people fly from England to the island. We've had people fly from Australia to the island, for, programs, and loved it. So again, I want to sort of put it out there that if you're interested in that, do that. But let's go back to the light, you know, this mom and dad seeing the light in them. And let's end with one last song. Never knowing who to cling to when the rain set in. Yeah. So we'll definitely see you on the other side. Don't forget, there'll be links for our guest and links for the songs and the show notes. And I will definitely see you on the other side, and make this a really tolerant, accepting, open, curious, fascinating week. And I will see you on the other side.
That Marilyn was found in the news, and it seems to me
that was Kick-Ass.